session number 11204 or 3.
Mr. Stan Ferguson, Reel 3.
Yeah.
What was the role of the carrier platoon, Mr. Ferguson, at Marath?
Well, just a support group, as usual. When the infantry got held up, we were there with extra machine guns, you know. That is all.
And did you actually get involved in the fighting?
Not myself. That was the time I was left out of battle for 24 hours, and the man who took my place was killed. The guy was hit in the side after he lost a leg, he was blown over, and that was it. So I didn't really know much about that particular battle, although I was there. I mean, 24 hours out of battle doesn't mean you go out of the area. It means you don't go in the front wave. It's a new scheme that started, I don't know why. I mean, after all the time we've been there, you know, you just got used to it kind of style, if you can get used to that situation. But the lads are quite bad, and the carriers, in this particular case, couldn't get forward. Even the tanks had a bit of a job, you know.
I mean, why was this?
Because of the terrain, you know, the sand and the air, the climbing to do, you just couldn't get out. You couldn't bridge it, you hadn't time. And of course, they were pretty tough in those days, those Germans, you know.
Being left out of battle, were you in a position where you could actually see what was going on in daylight?
No, you couldn't see, but as I say, you were within the call, kind of style. Well, back with the battalion, where the CO would be. They were in the front line, you know. They stopped behind out the road, always. Except, as I say, when we got chased down the desert, they were involved, they had to be. But otherwise, you're just out of battle.
So you didn't have any idea how the battle was going?
Not really, no. It was just handed over to the platoon and that was it, they carried on. I mean, they had four full sergeants in the platoon, you know. Either one could have taken over the whole platoon. I was supposed to be a battery sergeant major, whatever they call them, but they're just platoon sergeants. But I wasn't indispensable, if you get what I mean. Nobody was in the carrier platoon. We could all do the other's job. You know, fire the bang gun, drive, anything. That's the way we taught ourselves, so that we were never out of action.
So because of the difficulty of the terrain with the wadi and the anti-tank ditch, carriers didn't really get across?
Not really, no. Not to where they would be any good, if you know what I mean. They weren't in front. They couldn't dash up quickly. We were just there, waiting. In fact, it was a bit of a mucks up the whole lot, the area. I think we should have tried to go around, you know, wherever possible, but we didn't. And it was just one of them cases. Of course, I mean, we weren't the only ones that were stuck. There were other units at the same time, you know. They had the same problems.
Were the losses heavy?
No, not really. Not compared to the next battle, Wadi Akhthit. That was tougher still. Same kind of terrain, but I was three companies down about 65 men between them. They ran out of ammunition. The same situation, just couldn't get to them.
And what is the carrier's role in an action like that where there's a front company running out of ammunition?
Well, they're supposed to take it forward. I'll tell you that later on in Sicily, because I've got the job myself to do that. And it's not very pleasant, I can tell you, but normally you just carry enough ammunition to support. If they stuck with a machine gun nest, you help with it, but you don't charge it because it's suicide. See, one side of the carrier, I mean, they're armoured, but the front where the machine goes through, there's a space. So if you charge anything, the bullets can go through there and kill the commander and possibly smash the engine up at the back, you know. So you have to go down sideways or, you know, ease yourself forward. You don't discharge it. Not like the Yankee pitchers.
So attacking something like a machine gun strong point, you would be...
You wouldn't attack it head on. You'd itch down, possibly go down the side. I mean, you had a good protection from the sides. It would just rattle off like a tin plate, you know, with ordinary machine gun bullets. But anything above that, no. And if anybody was firing down at you, you were very vulnerable because there was no top. In fact, your hair was only about that far off the top, you know. Of course, when you went into action, you just sat on the floor and the driver looked through a little bulletproof glass. And his view was very limited. It was about 4 inches by 2 inches, roughly, this glass.
Did you yourself ever get involved in an attack on a position like that?
Oh, yes, I've been in them. Oh, yes, I mean, you have to, you know. But where? I mean, I can't isolate the positions. Oh, yes, I mean, these sort of things take you on sometimes, unawares. You know, you fight up, you don't realise it. If I was almost killed twice in Sicily, so that, you know, but mostly the guys, as they were just in reserve all the time. That was their role only, like the anti-tanks and like the mortars. They only went where they were sent. I mean, if they had a strong position in the infantry and they couldn't move, send for the mortar platoon. They'd have the mortars mounted on the carriers, which indeed was a 1-5-1 innovation. We designed that idea, fastened them on the front of the carriers permanent, and they could move by, you know. Then we'd send for them or the anti-tanks, whichever the case may be. But we never, never all charged as a platoon against anything. Not like the charge of the Life Brigade or anything like that. Never called for that. Others might have. It depends on the positions, you know, where you're at.
Were you ever used as reconnoitring ahead of the unit as it moved?
Oh, yes, patrols. Oh, yes, you had to go so far just to see what they... Well, I mean, it's not much you could say, you know, because the eye was so flat, you could see in many cases, mostly, you know. But there was some area where the CEO might want to say, is it clear up to there, kind of stand, you go forward, so far, and that was it. Come back, nothing there, nothing to be seen, you know.
Do you have any memories of Akkerit that followed Marat?
No. No. It's too long ago, as I say. It's difficult to describe a battle so long, 40 years, because, as I say, they're all the same. There's no variation. Bullets coming at you, shells coming at you, you fighting back, and that was it. The only difference was a different shape of hill, maybe it was on the left, or there might be a wadi in front of you, you know, but otherwise the terrain was all the same.
How did the communications work in a battle?
Well, they had the phones, but that's something we never really had any bother about. You know, we had all the instructions before we started, and we kept them instructions, and that was it. I mean, we never got called up on the phone kind of style with or a dispatch there, yeah? Because you couldn't, you know.
After Akkerit, where did you go?
Just up to Enfield. That was our end.
And what was your role in that advance?
Nothing there, just going forward, keeping in contact with the enemy, and then they decided, well, that's it, we'll have better use for you, and we turned around and came back nearly 2,000 miles to the Cairo area, you know, where the men started to learn how to get on board ship and how to get off. But of course, me, I don't know why, they picked me and said, look, there's invasion plans, there's 62 blend carriers, take them back up to Benghazi to get waterproof. Now, why me and not an officer, I'll never know. It was quite a responsibility, 62 of them guys, you know, all that distance. And we got waterproofed. And that's where we sailed from, Benghazi, to Sicily.
You sailed from Benghazi to
Sicily? Oh, yes, with the Benghazis. But you can't let the desert go without mentioning the flies. There were millions of them. Millions. Every time you ate your meal, you ate flies. You just couldn't avoid it. I mean, you got so used to it. I didn't like spitting out the wings. Other than that, you never bothered. And it did have a human size, the desert. I mean, I remember coming down about Tobruk. I was on the beach, call it a beach, about 3 foot 6 wide. And the truck was in the sea, and the other one was skating room at the bottom of a cliff, about 10 foot high. And I had the League of Nations on board. I had South Africans, 4th Indian Dave, me one. And I came across this little break in the cliff. And this fellow come running down, can you save me, mate? I always remember them words. Oh, yeah, fair enough. I got out, I couldn't get out the blanket either. And there was his mate lying on his stomach with a hole in his back, about the size of an inch. So I bent down to pick him up, my two arms, and his shell whoosh, right between my two arms, and it nicked the flesh. So I yanked the poor fellow up. I was pretty stomping him down, ran to the carrier, see? Well, about a mile further down, we came to an ambulance and some more RAP fellas. And I handed this wounded fellow over. And his mate come to me and said, how much have I owe? How much have I owe you, mate? Now, you know, I was looked at. I couldn't think of anything. How much have I owe you? He thought I was a taxi service. was funny.
Was this on the retreat from
On the retreat from Gazala, yeah. Dear me, I just thought, how much do I owe you? I've often wondered how them two lads are. If they got out, you know, anything like that.
When you moved back from Enfidaville to the Gulf, was that on your own tracks?
No, on the airway. When I moved up to Benghazi, I was up on Tanklan's quarters. Because I used to remember the night when we stopped for lager. I used to put them in a huge circle with the mortars pointing inwards and the Ben guns pointing, just in case, because you can never tell, you know, out there. There might have been somebody trapped in the desert, some Germans, like we were and we were one, you know. I took no chances, but it went off uneventful and I got them all waterproofed.
How did you waterproof?
Well, I put screens up and had some kind of glue or something to fill all the holes in, you know. But it wasn't really high. I should say an extra foot or so, you know. I also had an amplifier in the carrier for an interpreter, but I've never seen an interpreter yet. So, it was, I don't know. I've got a note in there with the money we got for Sicily. I've got a shilling note left. Have you seen them? A shilling note? Have you seen one? I'll let you see one with me.
When you went to Sicily, do you recall, was it a long journey?
No, it's a journey and a half, I can tell you. For the simple reason, it was the stormiest weather we'd ever known. And even the sailors were sick. Now, you can imagine us, three of us in the bottom of this little flat boat. It was dark. They were tossing about. They gave us some tea, but it was a waste of time because it got more over our faces when the boat was tossing up. And we're travelling along there and it was dark, as I say, and it was starting to get light. And I saw the top of these cliffs moving because I couldn't see over the top of the boat. I mean, there's 2,000 ships there, I never saw them. Saw this range of hills. So I said to that, oh, we're getting near there, get ready. And all of a sudden, we got a boof, just like that, and we stopped quick. I said, oh, we've landed. But when he let the front down, we're still out at sea. There's about 30 or 40 foot of water. He'd land on the sandbank and on the long beach. Get off. I said, how deep is it? Get off. And I was the first one off. Well, you can imagine what it was like, how deep the water, all that distance. Thankfully, it was in a cove. It was like a mill pond, the water. So I eased down and eased down and went to all the mud guards, came up to the waterproofing. There's about 4 inches left. And I stuck and I levelled off. So as I pulled along, the fellow behind me, he swung left. There's the army practice to spread out, you know. He disappeared. All I could see was the tin hats sticking above the water. Thankfully, they all got out. Now, this is the funny part. There was no tank traps. There was no barbed wire. There was no mines. And nobody fired a shot at us. And I can't help but thinking that if the whole battalion had landed there, that war might have finished so much quicker. Not a soul in sight. The point is with me, when I landed, where do we go? Which way do I turn? I mean, I didn't know where I was. Do I turn right or left? Thankfully, I turned left, and the battalion was about 3 miles down the road.
You didn't have an officer with you?
No. That's something I can't understand. Why no officer? I was a sergeant in charge of 62 carriers. I never saw the officer that we got in Sicily, Captain Medway. I never did see the second-in-command. But I always remember this Captain Medway because he's always singing Spurs jingle, jangle, jingle when he's sitting on top of my carrier. I always pick my carrier, I don't know why. And he got dysentery, poor fella. And he seemed to disappear. But officers seemed to go fast for some, I suppose, when the companies, you know. But
were there any officers that you were serving with at this time that didn't come up to your expectations?
No. All good. All good lads. In fact, there was two fellas. One was called Lieutenant Hurst and the other Captain Gardner, but he was more or less after Sicily, where the New Zealander, he's one of the lads, and he went with me to Tripoli, and there was a huge queue. I thought it was the pitchers. See? He said, I'll see you. What do you mean? That's you up there. It was a brothel. I never went, but he disappeared to be up there. He's one of them fellas. And he said, after the war, he said, I want you to come to New Zealand. And he says, look after my tractors. You can't hear that. And he got killed in France. But that is the one. And Captain Grant used to call us Stan. So it was a little happy family. Only on off there, kind of say. You know, once you're on there, it was sir this and sir that. But they were good lads.
So you landed on the wrong beach at Sicily?
I landed on the wrong beach at Sicily. And,
how did you know you were on the wrong beach?
Well, we were told on the boat it was a long beach. And I said to the fact that there was nobody there, not a sign of anything. I mean, normally when you go on beach, you have the mind cleared and things like that. I mean, when you're on a plane carrier, that's the thing you're always afraid of, minds, because you could never see them, you know. And I couldn't understand why we weren't shot at. Why the beach is like a normal pleasure beach. You know, unguarded, completely unguarded.
And you picked up the battalion...
Further down towards Avola. And it was I heard later one of the companies was having a bit of a battle with the Yankee paratroopers because neither side recognised the uniforms. You know, but anyway, as I say, we joined them at Avola. And then we had this forced march to Plymouth-Soley Bridge. Something else I didn't understand. The men set off, and I followed in a plane carrier. I thought, I'll pull forward. And I said to the officer, can I not take your phone and not carry it? Good idea. And so I leapfrogged in so far, then back with some more. And we stopped on this side of Plymouth-Soley Bridge, in the middle of the night, kind of side. A little narrow road, half the width of this one. And the company stopped on the left, and on the right-hand side of the road, there's a field, and a little wood, so me, I was sitting there, so I'm going off that wood, he said. So I drove through the field, across the field to the wood, and I just got through the field, and I heard a terrific bang behind us. I said, oh, God, blimey, the phone is already, you know. I got to the wood, got out, there wasn't a soul to be seen, they were still on the road. And just then, half a dozen tracks came through, half tracks came through from behind us. I'd cut them off by getting up so quick, at pandemonium. They were shooting both sides. Our fellows couldn't shoot back. They'd have shot at each other. And I remember this one going up in flames, and it landed right on my platoon area. So I got in my carrier, and I came back again. Then I saw the reason why they hadn't followed us. The one behind me had gone on the mine. And I'd driven over the minefield twice. No, no freaking boss about that. And I knew it was a minefield, because the next morning, a flail tank tried to clear the mine. It got blew up as well. So how can you dodge all in mines just like that? Twice. Anyway, we got all cleared up there. Then, of course, the battle itself, no side could make any headway. You know, the 6th had tried, the 8th had tried, and the 9th had tried. So I remember this particular day, I was in a ditch on the far side of the beach, on the Catania side, which was actually the German headquarters. And on my left was an old ruins of a house. So I was in this ditch, and this tank came up. First one I'd seen, mine.
This was a British tank?
British tank, first one I'd seen. I looked up, and it stopped. It wouldn't go around the corner. It must have seen the 88 around the corner when it was knocked out. And this jeep pulled up, and all I could see was the red band, so he could have been the brigadier or the general. And he laid the law down to that tank commander. So the tank pulled down the corner, and it went up to Stingali, which we call Stingali for obvious reasons, the dead bodies and the smell. And as he got to the alley, he turned left and stopped. And his gun was facing down the alley. And a pair of hands shot up. Then another, then another. Now this tank was in a vulnerable position, he was on his own. So I dashed out my then carrier, and as they came out, about 100, well, over 100, they put all the small arms in my carrier, and I took them back to BHQ as prisoners. That's not in any war book, that's a fact.
So the arms came into your carrier, and
I had the carrier in reverse, and I marched them all back over the bridge. Now, I always remember the officer there. Oh, miserable looking bloke. I asked him the time, and I forgot to give him his watch back. he'd always remember me, junior sergeant. And,
was this the British officer, was it?
No, German. The German Hermann Göring division. Now, they were so good a fighter, our CEO shook hands with them. But apparently they'd heard that we weren't taking prisoners. You know, so you know, I don't know how tough they were. There's one little part I missed out, just after the mining. One of the companies had run out of ammo. This is what I was going to tell you about before. So I loaded one of the carriers, chock-a-block, with all kinds of ammunition, bombs, you know, the lot. Now, I couldn't ask a fellow to drive it in such condition, it was suicidal, really, so I just took it myself. Now, I was going across this bridge, imagine, this long bridge on my own, and for some reason it was quiet, like a Sunday morning, not a shot anywhere. And I was just wondering, where are they? I didn't know where anybody was, you know. And I got to yon side, and the voice said, "Where are you going, mate?" And I looked over, I saw one B company. "Oh," he said, "they've gone." He said, "If you go down there, she'll not get back." So I remember, I turned the thing down on the spot, and I went hell for leather back to the battalion. One of them things, you know. It was a terrible feeling. I mean, if anything had hit that carrier, I'd have blown a bridge up and all. It was so loaded, you know. It was just one of those things. And I remember when I took the prisoners back to the BHQ, I went back over the bridge again, and I walked along Stingalley with the paddy. And we stepped over this dead German, and we just stepped over and he said, "Hi, Hitler!" And he threw a grenade at us. Well, thankfully, he hadn't had time to prime it, you see. So I looked at the fella, "Do you know, could I hell shoot him?" "I just couldn't shoot him." I said, "The paddy, what should I do?" He said, "Leave him, he's dying." And he was. But he's such a fanatic, Heil Hitler. Poor fella, he's badly wounded. I mean, you could see, you know. I just thought, no, the one was a tough battle. And we lost 500 dozens, killed, missing and wounded, you know. They lost 300 out of 3 battalions.
What were the prisoners like, were they?
Oh, surly, surly looking. Tough. You know, there's no give or take on them. They didn't say, "Are you mate?" Or anything like that. But we gave them cigarettes and accepted them. I think, as I say myself, I think they were more shocked than getting taken prisoner because they expected to be killed. And actually they knew who we were. Now, how they knew that, I don't know, because somebody kept shouting, "How's it and gets it? How's your missus? You shout with the Yanks." Things like that, you know. And we didn't know who they were. Such as their intelligence or those, I don't know, but they knew us.
Have you any other memories of Primus Over the Bridge?
Not really. I see the minefield, going over the minefield twice, being attacked from the rear with a half dozen tracks.
Where did they come from?
In a little alley, one of the lanes. And see, I told, I lifted the men up on as a you know, shuttle service, and we must have cut them off. And during the night, of course, they made a dash because the bridge was the only way they could get them over, you see, so they came through. Well, our anti-tank guns were facing towards the bridge, and as they came from the back, they shot our lads in the legs. The first one got through, I mean by surprise. The second one hit a honey tank, which was parked on the side. The third one just blew up. And all night long, the things were crackling in the car, you know. And one fella jumped out. Now, these are Italian guys, but this fella, it's funny this, he shouted, "Camelot." He put his hands over his head, and he ran up the road, and nobody hit him. No, not a soul hit him. They couldn't. I didn't know why. I think they thought maybe, well, if they missed him, they'll hit their own lads. But he got away. Camelot, well, that means German, not Italian. So that's debatable, whether they were Italian half-tracks or German half-tracks. Because, I mean, you couldn't really tell from where we were, you know. But I certainly heard them say Camelot, and that's definitely German.
You lost your commanding officer at...
Clark. Colonel. Oh, kind of little fella. We didn't have much to do with them, you know. But, I mean, our other one was Percy, and he was with us most of the time. I think Clark just joined us at Sicily, so we didn't have much to do, you know. I mean, when you've been on parades and things like that, the church, you get to know them. But, I mean, we had nothing like that. In fact, some of us you never saw, you know. I mean, I never saw the company officers, that's why I don't remember the names. And he was down with the second command, Big Bill Robinson, and the shell fell and killed them both.
So after the Primosoli Bridge, you would move forward?
Up to Catania.
And what memories have you of the rest of the campaign?
Nothing there, just quiet. Just quiet, just two of them there and saying that everything was all right, you know. We're going to buy Agatha Gali and places like Tolomino. I remember that place because I went up the step, I went up the hard way, I went up all the steps of the bank, yeah. And they had a marketplace on at the top and they looked at me and I squeezed through all the barriers, you know. It was funny. Yeah.
How did the Italians receive you, or the Sicilians receive you?
Well, I don't know, we didn't have much to do with them, you know. I mean, you don't have down civilians in cases like that. They seemed reasonable enough. You know what I mean? There's no hatey kind of style. Passive, that's the word, passive. I remember one little party in Sicily, in a town, I'm not sure if it was Avola or one of them, or Lentini, And the roads were made of squares, square blocks, you know, and the truck came off. And I remember me bogey wheel was jammed against the curb. So I got a big crowbar, and I lifted it, knocked it off, you know. And this fella passed me, said, "Stark." I said, "Stark." And, you know, it was only 3 years later, I knew what Stark meant, strong. So it's obviously been a German in civilians. Only I didn't know at the time. He'd slipped by saying Stark. It's funny how these things turn out. Because I learned to speak the German a bit in Berlin, you know. Other than that, I didn't know. So the campaign was over then, as far as we were concerned. There's nothing more to do, you know, except to come back home.
So you came back home?
We came back home too.
About what time was this?
August 43, we'll be based right there. And that went down to Saffron Walden.
When you got back home, were you given any leave?
No, I think we were. No. We got extra blankets because of the cold.
And you went to Saffron Walden?
Transit camp there. We confined to camp because of the coming invasion, you know. And that was where I had my accident. And I was put in hospital for nearly a month, actually. Lost my memory, everything. I was sent to St. Albans military. It was a civilian hospital in Saffron Walden, by the way. I was sent to St. Albans military hospital, and then from there to Bedford. And when I was at Bedford, I was sent to this Scottish unit, which is some debate about the 52nd Highland Light Infantry. And we moved to France, D-Day plus so-so-so-so.
How long were you with the Highlanders?
3 days, 4 days. Not enough to know anything about them.
Then you came back to the...
I saw the TT signs in France, near Bier, and I went across, and I was transferred immediately back. I don't know how they did it, mate. I may be posted missing on the other for all I know, but I was accepted back.
So you were put with Highland Light Infantry for 3 or 4 days?
3 or 4 days.
And in that time, you were taken over to France?
Into France with them.
Mm-hmm. And you joined up with the 9th where?
Round about Bier, just before the Valley Gap, before the big fighting started, you know. And...
Who was colonel of the battalion at this time when you joined them?
Colonel Mogg. He just joined as a major. And I always remember he was saying about the all the lads, all the medals. And he said, "All I've got something to go out to college." He'd tell you that. He said he felt ashamed at the time. And he got me this particular job, more or less finished with the fighting. So I wanted to travel with the carriers, but to keep them in good condition. If they blow down during the action, you get out and get it going. And that's more or less all I did after the rest of the war.
So were you at Langevin?
Yes, and that was the night where, I think, today, anyway, I think the Germans did it deliberate. They left a stock, what they call them, bonnet place, full of cognac, chock-a-block. And of course, we found it, and we tasted it, and we liked it. And I remember going up this main street, a little bit in another street, and I went into the house. Of course, it was all empty, nobody in. The house was intact, mine, and I found this German butter, the swastika. I always remember this, and I put it in my map pocket, down the front of my trousers, you know, swigging away there. And I went into the bedroom, and I fell flat on my face. When I came round, I heard a da-da-da-da-da, da-da-da-da. This tanker come down the main street.
German tanker.
I think it was a Tiger. Now, it was rumoured, I don't know if it was true or not, that he knocked out 15 Shermans on the way down. And Colonel Mogg organised the gun to knock it out from the RAP post, so it shows you how far he got down. And I still think that brand new left there for that purpose. Because we never heard him, none of us.
And how many of the... was there at this place?
Well, everybody. At least a company, I should think. In this one street, you know. I mean, the whole battalion was down the area, like. But,
And how many of you found the wine and...
Well, I should think a lot of them did. I mean, I know I had about 5 or 6 cases full on my carrier. And of course, the infantry, well, they'll have drunk it as they were going on, you know. But, I mean, otherwise, how could he get so far, the tango they were being seen, you know? And I was just going by my own example. I mean, I didn't think, that's the funny part about it. I never did like beer or anything like that. Because I remember when I got my face split open, the doctor said a pint would kill you. And I didn't want to go through life with that thing on my mind, you know. I was down in Devon at the time. I went down and I had 15 pints. Just like that. One, of course, it was waste stuff. And it had no effect. But it eased my mind a lot that to think that I could do it, you know. But I hate the stuff.
So in the middle of this battle, you found this drink?
And, I found this drink. I had a good drink. And I squashed all the butter. Dear me, I don't know how long I was on the bed. It couldn't have been long.
It was quite a severe action, wasn't it?
Oh, yes, aye. Well, as I say, this tank, the tremendous tanks, you know, these German tanks. The one we saw had concrete on the front, then tracks on the front of the concrete. And, I mean, the life was no use against that with a machine gun, you know. The only thing we could knock it out with is a bazooka. But you've got to get down close for one of them things, you know. The Piat mortars, we call them. The Yanks call them bazookas.
Where did you move to after that?
Oh, that's something I wouldn't know. I couldn't tell you anything about that now. It was a God's place, as I said before. All my main job was to keep the guys in good order.